Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome back. Today we're diving into a classic that honestly still feels incredibly raw and powerful, Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights.
It really does.
And it's so much more than just a romance, isn't it? It's this intense, almost terrifying gothic journey into obsession, identity, and the really destructive power of revenge.
And you can't really grasp the book without thinking about where it came from. Emily Bronte herself, quite an enigmatic figure.
Definitely. Reclusive, living in that isolated parsonage in Helworth.
Right, in Yorkshire.
Yeah.
And she basically channels the spirit of those wild, untamed moors right onto the page. It's harsh, it's bleak.
It's practically a living character in the novel, reflecting all that raw human emotion. You know, we need to appreciate how shocking this was back in 1847.
Oh, absolutely.
Published under a male pseudonym, Ellis Bell, it completely defied what Victorian readers expected, that sort of moral tidiness.
They weren't ready for it. Critics found it strange, even coarse, loathsome.
Because Bronte just lays bare this kind of human cruelty and passion that polite society, well, they just wanted to ignore. And the whole structure is built on these stark contrasts. You've got the two houses, Wuthering Heights, wild, chaotic, elemental, representing that sort of raw nature. Yeah.
And then Thrushcross Grange, all refined, orderly, civilized.
Yeah.
Maybe even a bit stifling.
Exactly. It symbolizes society, hierarchy, maybe constraint. The whole story is really a battle between those two forces playing out over generations.
It is.
So today, let's trace that tragic path. But first, the way the story is told is quite unusual. Bronte doesn't just start at the beginning. Talk about Mr. Lockwood. Why start there?
Well, it's a really clever framing device. Lockwood, the new tenant, shows up at Wuthering Heights, meets this incredibly hostile Heathcliff.
Right, this dark, brooding figure.
And he hears about Catherine's ghost, gets completely spooked and intrigued. So his curiosity leads him to Nellie Dean, the housekeeper.
Okay, Nellie Dean. And she's the one who actually tells most of the story.
She tells almost all of it, yeah. Looking back over, 30 years? So it's all retrospective, nonlinear.
But that immediately makes you think, Nellie Dean, can we actually trust everything she says? I mean, she's right in the middle of it all.
That's the brilliant part. She's definitely not objective. Critics call it a nested narrative structure. Lockwood hears Nellie's version. And Nellie, well, she has her own biases, her own morality.
So she might shade things, maybe leave bits out.
Could be. She was often loyal to the Lintons, maybe because of her position. She clearly judges Heathcliff by her own, perhaps rather strict standards.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, she claims she's just passing messages, but you wonder if she isn't stirring the pot a little.
Interesting. So we, the readers, have to kind of piece things together through her potentially biased lens. Okay, let's get into Nellie's story then. It all begins with Heathcliff's arrival, doesn't it?
Yes. Mr. Earnshaw finds this little boy, this dark foundling, on the streets of Liverpool and just brings him home to Wuthering Heights.
And right away, there's this connection between him and the daughter, Catherine Earnshaw.
An incredibly fierce bond. Almost unnatural, some might say. They're inseparable, running wild on the moors. It's like they're two halves of the same soul from the start.
But that instantly creates conflict, right, with the son, Hindley.
Immediate conflict. Hindley is jealous and resentful from day one. And then the real turning point. Mr. Earnshaw dies.
Yes.
And that's when Hindley takes over Wuthering Heights. The social hierarchy just slams down.
And he takes it out on Heathcliff. Brutally.
Completely degrades him. Takes away his education, his standing, treats him like a common laborer. That social humiliation is absolutely crucial. It's the fuel for everything that follows.
And at the same time, Catherine gets a taste of the other side.
Right. She has that accident while spying on the Lintons at Thrushcross Grange. Spends 5 weeks there recovering.
And gets seduced by that refined lifestyle, the status, the elegance.
Exactly. It tempts her. Offers her a way out, maybe, from the roughness, the wildness. And maybe from the social degradation that Hindley's forcing on Heathcliff.
So this leads to the big, disastrous choice. She has to pick between Heathcliff, her soulmate, basically, and Edgar Linton, the respectable gentleman.
And she chooses Edgar. Accepts his proposal.
But she knows it's wrong, doesn't she? There's that famous confession to Nellie.
Oh, it's heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
She tells Nellie her love for Edgar is like the foliage in the woods. Superficial, changeable.
Time will change it.
Yeah. But her love for Heathcliff, that's like the eternal rocks beneath. Essential. Necessary, even if it's not pleasant.
She says she's doing it partly to help Heathcliff raise him up with Edgar's status.
But in doing it, she betrays herself. And worse.
Heathcliff overhears part of it.
Just the worst part. He hears her say marrying him would degrade her.
Oh, devastating.
He doesn't hear the rest, the eternal rocks part. He just hears the rejection based on class. And he vanishes, disappears for 3 years.
And the cycle of revenge is truly set.
When he comes back, he's transformed. He's wealthy. He looks polished, gentlemanly on the surface.
But underneath?
Underneath. That early pain and humiliation have just hardened into this focused, calculated cruelty. He's not interested in happiness. His wealth is purely a tool for revenge.
And he goes about it so systematically. First, Hindley.
Mm-hmm. He exploits Hindley's weaknesses, gambling, drinking until he gets complete control of Wuthering Heights itself. Destroys him utterly.
And he turns his attention to Edgar Linton, not directly attacking him, but tormenting him psychologically.
Right, by marrying Edgar's innocent sister, Isabella.
Who has this romantic notion of Heathcliff as a Byronic hero.
And he subjects her to terrible abuse. It's purely strategic malice.
Mm.
It gets him inside the Grange financially and emotionally.
This constant tension, this impossible triangle, it literally destroys Catherine, doesn't it?
It does. She's torn apart. There's that final raw, desperate confrontation between her, Heathcliff, and Edgar.
Mm.
And the strain kills her. She dies just after giving birth to her daughter, young Catherine.
And Heathcliff. His reaction is terrifying. It's not grief. It's something else.
It's pure agony and rage. That famous curse. May she wake in torment.
I cannot live without my life. I cannot live without my soul.
He practically begs her ghost to haunt him. He'd rather be tormented by her presence than live without her entirely. That obsessive grief becomes his whole reason for living for the next decade or so.
So the trauma just carries over into the next generation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The cycle of abuse continues. Fast forward about a decade, Heathcliff is master of Wuthering Heights, and he has Hindley's son, Hareton Earnshaw, under his thumb.
And what does he do to Hareton?
He deliberately keeps him ignorant, uneducated, rough, mimicking the way Hindley treated him. It's the ultimate revenge on the Earnshaws.
He's using the children like pawns.
Exactly, especially Edgar's daughter, young Catherine, Kathy Linton. He manipulates her situation.
Forces her into contact with his own son, Lytton Heathcliff.
Who is sickly, cruel, really upon himself. Heathcliff forces Kathy to marry Linton.
Just to get control of Thrushcross Grange when Edgar dies.
Right. And Linton dies soon after, leaving Heathcliff in possession of both estates. Wuthering Heights and Thrushcross Grange. His revenge seems complete. Financially, at least.
He's essentially recreated the conditions of his own suffering, making victims of the children of his enemies. It seems utterly bleak.
It does. The cycle looks unbreakable.
But then Bronte introduces a possibility of redemption, doesn't she? Something shifts with this second generation.
Yes, it's crucial. Despite growing up in this atmosphere of hate and degradation, they're different. Hareton, even though Heathcliff has kept him down, still has this kind of innate decency, a natural nobility.
And young Catherine. She goes through hell, but it seems to teach her something. Compassion. Humility.
I think so. She loses her initial snobbery. She's forced into the reality her mother fled. And she starts to see Hareton differently.
Beyond the rough exterior that Heathcliff deliberately created.
Exactly. And this leads to that key moment. The real turning point for breaking the cycle.
Education again.
Yes. She starts teaching Hareton to read.
It's such a powerful symbol. Literacy as liberation.
It represents compassion, mutual respect, seeing the person underneath. It's completely different from the destructive, all-consuming passion of Catherine and Heathcliff. Their love, Kathy and Hareton's, is built on, well, unkindness and learning together.
It's about nurturing, not possessing.
Precisely. A love based on conscious choice, maybe even virtue, rather than just that elemental, fated connection.
And Heathcliff sees this happening. How does he react?
That's the really strange part of his ending. He watches them. He sees aspects of the first Catherine and young Kathy, and maybe echoes of Hindley, or even himself as a youth, in Hareton. But they're finding peace together.
And somehow that breaks him. Or breaks his need for revenge.
It seems to extinguish his will. He says something like he's lost his faculties for destruction. Seeing the past sort of repeating, but corrected, maybe makes his whole life's project seem pointless.
So his obsession shifts back entirely to the first Catherine.
Completely. He starts seeing her ghost everywhere. Stops eating, detaches from the world. He's seeking that spiritual reunion.
And his death is eerie.
Very. They find him dead in Catherine's old room, the window open to the rain, with his fierce, almost joyful grimace on his face, like he finally achieved that union in death.
So the storm finally passes. Kathy and Harriton inherit both houses, plan to marry, bringing peace and maybe a healthier kind of love. Lockwood visits the graves, Catherine, Edgar, Heathcliff, side by side. A quiet end.
Let's circle back to that core idea, that quote, "I am Heathcliff." What does that really mean? It's not just love, is it?
No.
It goes way beyond romance. It's about identity.
Yeah.
She's saying he's not just someone she loves. He's intrinsically part of her being. Essential. Like breathing.
And her tragedy was trying to deny that essential self, choosing the civilization of the Grange over the nature of the moors and Heathcliff.
Exactly. That choice fractured her identity and ultimately destroyed them both. It violated her authentic self.
Bronte really drives these themes home with symbolism too, doesn't she?
Oh, constantly. The houses themselves, obviously. But also the weather. Those relentless storms always seem to mirror the internal turmoil.
Right. Crisis equals storm.
And think about windows and doors. They're always separating people, acting as barriers between inside and outside. Safety and danger, the living and, well, the dead or the spectral past.
It's such a complex, layered novel. And it doesn't offer easy answers about good and evil. Heathcliff is monstrous, but he starts as a victim.
That's one of its most challenging aspects. It forces you to confront how deeply suffering can corrupt someone, how trauma can perpetuate itself. The victim becomes the victimizer. It resists any simple moral judgment.
So thinking about why it still resonates, maybe it's that fearless look at intense passion versus moral responsibility.
And perhaps the ultimate message, shown through Kathy and Harriton, is that only things like forgiveness, compassion, education, only those can break those really deep, destructive cycles.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by a Katra Foundation.